This is Nancy Pippin with the Pantograph for Wednesday, April 26, 2017. And opening up today, we have a local story about Joyner Kersey emphasizing hard work at her Women's Health Night by Paul Swish. What Sports Illustrated greatest female athlete of the 20th century treasures most is her athletic career. Was not the sixth time she stood to receive the medals at four Summer Olympics. What I treasure most is the work that went into being the best, Jackie Joyner Kersey told members of the Illinois Wesleyan University track and field team Tuesday. My best wasn't winning, she said. It was knowing that when I went on that track, I would do my best. Joyner Kersey spoke with the student athletes in an impromptu question and answer session at the 19th Women's Health Night at IWU's Shirk Center, Bloomington. About 2,000 people attended the five-hour event presented by Illinois Heart and Lung Foundation, which also included a speech by Jackie Joyner Kersey and a fun run with her. More than 60 vendors also provided health screenings and information. Her speech was inspiring, student athlete Amelia Gluck said following Joyner Kersey's question and answer. Gluck hugged the First Lady of Track and Field following her remarks. Gluck, a Tremont native who is a junior at IWU majoring in health and wellness, is a long jumper who is working through injuries. Yesterday was a low point, she admitted. Hearing her today gave me the drive to go forward. She talked about setbacks and comebacks from injuries, Gluck said. It put me in the right mindset. We're a close team, Gluck said. This was important to us. Joyner Kersey won medals at the 1984, 88, 92, and 96 Olympic Games in the long jump and heptathlon, which includes the 100-meter hurdles, long jump, javelin throw, 200-meter run, high jump, 800-meter run, and shot put. She holds the world heptathlon record. I had to go to that line believing I could do it, Joyner Kersey, 55, told the Pantograph. Putting in the work gave me the confidence. Joyner Kersey didn't have an easy path. She grew up in poverty in East St. Louis and has struggled with asthma her entire life. She was diagnosed at age 18, but it wasn't until 4 years later that she took it seriously. I didn't take my medicine every day like I should have, she admitted. During one training session, she suddenly couldn't breathe. I was frightened, she said. She learned to take her medicine regularly to avoid or manage asthma triggers and to work more closely with her primary care physician and later a pulmonologist. I stopped looking at doctors and nurses as the enemy and began to think of them as coaches, she said. Dr. Cha Chu, a pulmonologist with Advocate Medical Group, told Joyner Kersey that when young people diagnosed with asthma ask him, "Will my life be limited by this?" he tells them, "One of the greatest athletes of all time is an Olympian who won gold medals with her asthma." You can't let it limit you, Chu said. He tells young patients, "You need to take your medicine and manage your triggers. Not a week goes by that I don't use you as an example," Chu told Joyner Kersey. "Thank you. You are my athletic hero," he said, and then they hugged. Joyner Kersey lives in St. Louis and has a foundation and center in East St. Louis, where we use sports as a hook to get kids in the door and provide them with a safe place to learn life skills, she said. The center also provides seniors with physical activity. Jackie exemplifies what it means to be fit in all aspects of your life, said Sarah Klieg of Illinois Heart and Lung. Fitness can change in an instant, but it can remain a part of who you are. She inspires people to be that best version of ourselves. My message is the same for all, Joyner Kersee said. You gotta work hard, both on and off the field. We all face difficult times. Never give up. There is a story within all of us, she said. You determine what you want your story to be. You have the power to do that. And at the conclusion of this article, we have three pictures of Joyner Kersee provided by David Prober of the Pantograph. And now we will move on to a story about education. Heartland Board okays dipping into reserves if necessary. This by Lenore Swoboda. The Heartland Community College Board gave administrators the go-ahead Tuesday to consider dipping into reserves if necessary to offset uncertainty about state funding. The intent is to preserve program quality, minimize disruptions, and not have to take radical actions because of continued uncertainty about state funding, explained President Rob Widmer. No formal vote was taken, but heads nodded affirmatively when Widmer asked the board, "Are you comfortable with the direction we are going?" A tentative budget for the fiscal year beginning July 1st will be presented to the board for adoption in June, and a final budget will follow in September. In explaining what was meant by, quote, radical actions, Widmer said, "We got burned on adult education. Last year, the college cut 29 classes in its adult education program, which provides instruction in areas such as GED, high school equivalency degrees, English as a second language, because state funding wasn't forthcoming. The state approved funding on the last day of the fiscal year. Too late to do much good." Doug Mentor, Vice President of Business Services, presented board members with several scenarios related to state funding, including one based on receiving no money from the state for several years, even though that is considered unlikely. Mentor did not give exact figures, but he said it is a goal to have an operating fund reserve of about 25% of what projected expenditures are for a year. It currently represents about 18% of projected expenditures. By using existing fund balances, we have the ability to ride out the storm, Mentor said. But both Mentor and Widmer said using the fund balance is not a sustainable strategy. Under the worst-case scenario, the fund balance will drop to zero in fiscal year 2020. However, if the worst-case scenario or even a slightly worse case developed, Mentor said the college would regroup and would not let that happen. The college already has taken several steps to control expenses, but that shouldn't excuse the state from its responsibility, said Mentor. The message we want to get out is Heartland is alive and well because we are prepared for such situations and the state has to get back on board, he said. Craig Chadwith, who was reelected as board chairman Tuesday night, said he liked this approach because this allows us to spend more time thinking about what we want the college to be rather than when is the next check going to come. Mentor often has used a, quote, wild card metaphor when discussing budget. In today's climate, it feels like we're playing a game of roulette instead of a card game where the wild cards become known, he said. State funding isn't the college's only worry. Another challenge looms, which Mentor referred to as the quote-unquote fiscal cliff, the loss of the ability to levy what's called your, quote, equity tax that is based on the district's operating property tax rate compared to the statewide average. The district is authorized to use the equity tax only if it is eligible for state equalization grants. that is based on a complex formula related to a district property assessments and student enrollment. The state grants amount to about $50,000, but the equity tax can bring in about $3 million, Mentor said. The district anticipates losing equity tax authority after fiscal 2018. In other business, the board seated newly elected member Mary Campbell, who, along with Chadwick, won the April 4th election. The board also seated a new student board member, Renee Vassen of Normal, a freshman majoring in communications. At the close of this article, we see a picture of the library and of Mr. Widmer, the president of the college. And now we'll talk about something in the area of crime in courts. And that is, the title is Judge, Woman Who Says She Saw Zimmerman Can Testify, by Edith Brady Lundley. A woman who claims she saw Kirk Zimmerman outside the... And we will move on now here. Circuit Judge Scott Jaworski ruled that a jury should determine the credibility of Maria Legg's identification of Zimmerman on November 3, 2014, hours before Pam Zimmerman's body was found in her East Side Bloomington office. The judge's ruling came Tuesday morning during a hearing on pretrial motions. A trial date has not been set. At a previous hearing, Legg said she told her husband about seeing a man fitting Zimmerman's physical description after she read about the homicide in the Pantograph the following day. She said she saw the man she later identified as Zimmerman as she was placing items in a recycle bin at a church next door to the office complex in the 2100 block of East Washington Street. Pam Zimmerman was found in her office on December 4, 2014, lying on the floor, shot four times by her ex-husband, according to the first-degree murder charges filed against him. He allegedly killed his ex-wife because he was angry over her recent engagement and disputes over money. St. Louis defense lawyer John Rogers characterized Legg's March testimony, in which she was unable to positively identify herself in a paused video displayed in the courtroom, as a, quote, bizarre, and asked the judge to bar her from testifying at Zimmerman's trial. Legg's identification, quote, is one of the worst out-of-court identifications and photo lineups I've ever seen, end quote, said Rogers. In a March ruling, Jaworski ruled that a jury will not hear testimony about a computerized police lineup in which Zimmerman was identified by Legg. He said Legg's identification could be considered overly suggestive based upon a flawed process used by the Bloomington police to obtain her opinion. On Tuesday, the witness's husband, Charles Legg, testified that the trip to the recycling center was unusual for his wife, who rarely goes outside without him and seldom drives. He said he was out of town when his wife drove to St. Luke's Union Church to drop off recyclables. Legg first told her husband about the encounter with a man in the parking lot when he returned home about 3 days later, according to Charles Legg's testimony. Legg said his wife became emotional when she read about Pam Zimmerman's murder the following day, after she recognized the victim as a person who came to a yard sale at the Legg's home in the summer of 2014. Maria Legg was again upset in July of 2015 when she read an arrest had been made in the murder case and she saw photos of the suspect. When the picture was in the paper of Mrs. Zimmerman and Mr. Zimmerman, she said, "That's the man I saw at the recycling at the church the night she was by herself," Charles Legge told the judge. When Maria Legge wanted to go to the police with her identification, her husband stopped her. "I told her no, stay out of it," Legge testified, explaining that he feared his wife's emotional and physical well-being could be affected by involvement in a murder investigation. The topic of the Zimmerman case did not come up again until the fall of 2015, when Maria Legge talked about her potential sighting with friends at a fast food restaurant. Neither the Leggs nor their friends went to the police, according to Charles Legge's testimony. Police learned of Maria Legge's alleged encounter with the suspect in March of 2016 after a person who overheard a conversation about her claim with people at a public event told police. Assistant State's Attorney Mary Knoll argued that Legge's identification of Zimmerman is solid and based upon her independent recollection and not the improper police lineup. The identification was positive and cemented long before police came to her house for the lineup, said Cole. The fact that Legge also recalls seeing election equipment being set up at the church for the November 4, 2014 election solidified her claim as to when she was in the parking lot, said the prosecutor. 4 days of hearings are scheduled starting May 15th on the state's motion to include testimony from more than a dozen witnesses who allegedly heard comments about Pam Zimmerman's fears for her ex-husband. The 58-year-old suspect remains free on $200,035 bond that requires him to wear a GPS monitor and limits his travel to medical and legal appointments. And at close, we have pictures of Mr. Zimmerman and Mr. Zimmerman and his lawyer, John Rogers. Our final note in the front page is out of Washington. Lawmakers suggest former Trump aide Flynn broke U.S. law. This is by Chad Day and Stephen Braun of the Associated Press. President Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn appeared to violate federal law when he failed to seek permission or inform the U.S. government about accepting tens of thousands of dollars from Russian organizations after a trip there in 2015, leaders of the House Oversight Committee said Tuesday. The congressman also raised new questions about fees Flynn received as part of $530,000 in consulting work his company performed for a businessman tied to the Turkey's government. The bipartisan accusations that Flynn may have broken the law came as his foreign contacts are being examined by other congressional committees as part of investigations into Russian meddling in the 2016 election and potential ties between Trump associates and the Kremlin. Congress returned earlier this week from its spring recess, and Tuesday's announcement reflected renewed interest on Capitol Hill. Representative Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah, and Elijah Cummings, Democrat of Maryland, said they saw no evidence that Flynn, a retired Army Lieutenant General, properly disclosed foreign payments he received to military officials on his security clearance paperwork. Flynn, who headed the military's top intelligence agency, was Trump's national security advisor until he was fired in February. Among the payments in question were more than $33,000 that Flynn received in 2015 from the Russian Today television network, which has been described by U.S. intelligence officials as a propaganda front for the Russian government. Chaffetz said Flynn was obligated as a retired Army officer to request permission from both the defense and State Departments about prospective foreign government payments before he received them. There was nothing in the data that show General Flynn complied with the law, Chaffetz said. Cummings said Flynn's failure to formally report the Russian payments on his security clearance paperwork amounted to concealment of the money, which could be prosecuted as a felony. Flynn's lawyer, Robert Kilner, said Flynn reported his plan to travel to Russia to his former agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he briefed officials there after he returned. Kilner declined to answer questions about whether Flynn properly disclosed the payments. The congressman spoke after reviewing classified documents regarding Flynn that were provided by the Defense Intelligence Agency. They were also briefed by agency officials. The congressman declined to describe in detail the materials they reviewed, but Cummings said the documents, quote, were extremely troubling, and he urged the administration to declassify them. Chaffetz and Cummings said they plan to write to the Comptroller of the Army and the Defense Department Inspector General for a final determination as to whether Flynn broke the law and whether the government needs to pursue criminal charges and seek to recover the payments Flynn received. Cummings also criticized the White House for refusing to return over documents the committee requested about Flynn's foreign contacts during his 3-week stint as the National Security Advisor. In response to a letter to White House Chief of Staff Rance Priebus, an administration official told the committee that the documents relating to these contacts likely contained classified and other sensitive information and weren't relevant to the committee's investigation and could not be turned over. That's simply unacceptable, Cummings said. At the White House, Press Secretary Sean Spicer said the committee's request for Flynn's security clearance information was referred to the Defense Department, which turned over documents. He said the White House did not release detailed lists of Flynn's contacts with foreign officials, a request dismissed as outlandish. Spicer said the president was confident in his decision to fire Flynn in February on grounds that he had misled the vice president about a conversation he'd had with Russian ambassador to the U.S. during the transition. Spicer declined to say whether the White House believed Flynn had violated the law. He said the conduct occurred before Flynn was appointed National Security Advisor in January. Kilner, Flynn's attorney, said in a statement that Flynn briefed the Defense Intelligence Agency about the Moscow event organized by the Russia Today news organization. Flynn had led the spy agency until 2014 when he was forced to retire by the Obama administration. During his briefings, Flynn answered any questions that were posed by the DIA concerning the trip, Kilner said. The spokesman for the Defense Intelligence Agency, Jim Kudla, said Flynn briefed the agency in advance of his trip to Moscow in accordance with the standard security clearance procedures. A spokesman for Flynn said that Flynn had also disclosed the Russian trip when he last came up for security clearance review in January of 2016. Chaffetz and Cummings said the documents they received showed no evidence Flynn asked permission for the payments or later detailed the amounts he received to military authorities. Chaffetz added that while it would be a bit strong to say that Flynn flat out lied, he should have sought and received permission before accepting any foreign government payments. Both Cummings and Chaffetz said the committee's investigation into Flynn's foreign payments include examining consulting work he did for a Turkish businessman last year. Flynn's firm registered as a foreign agent last month with the Justice Department for the consulting work and acknowledged that it may have principally benefited the government of Turkey. Flynn's client, Invo BV, is owned by a Turkish businessman who also is also a member of a committee overseen by the Turkish Finance Ministry. So in government filings, Flynn disclosed that he personally received between $50,000 and $100,000 as part of his stake in Flynn Intel Group, the company that performed the foreign agent work. Now, earlier Tuesday, a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, they announced a public panel on May the 8th to hear testimony for the first time from the former Acting Attorney General, Sally Yates, who played a role in Flynn's firing. Yates was supposed to testify publicly for the House Intelligence Committee in March, but that was canceled and has yet to be rescheduled. Now, some Democrats believe the White House wants to limit what Yates says publicly, but the White House has denied this. Former National Intelligence Director James Clapper is also to testify at the May 8th hearing. Now, also Tuesday, there were complaints from the Senate investigation was not moving quickly enough. Democratic Senators Kamala Harris, Dianne Feinstein of California said they believed the committee needed to move at a faster rate. Now, preliminary interviews now have been completed with about 27 people from the intelligence agencies. And there are 9 staffers working full-time on the investigation, according to one aide, who was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly and spoke only on condition of anonymity. By contrast, the House Select Committee on Benghazi employed more than 50 congressional staffers. The aide said the committee has gained access to additional materials at intelligence agencies, including categories and types of intelligence documents that have never been provided to Congress before. Committee members and staff are reviewing thousands of pages of materials at CIA headquarters and the National Security Agency. At the conclusion of the article is a this is a byline from the Associated Press, again by Chad Day and Stephen Braun. And this is kind of the looks like the about the closing of our front page. And we hope that you will stay tuned with us as we take a short break. And as we take this break, we will return for the second half of the Pantograph. That is for Wednesday, April the 26th, 2017. So thank you so much for listening this first half. See you again on the second half.